Modern times, as we know, are much different from ancient times. If a young woman today becomes a widow, what options does she have? Well, virtually anything. She could go back to her original home. She could maybe get remarried. She could go to school. She could get a new job. She could move from one place to another. She could do virtually anything that is available to her in our modern culture. And there's really not many restrictions. Women today, whether you're single, whether you're married, whether you're widowed, whatever your occupation, whatever your, you know, options might be, there are many of them. There's not too many restrictions on what women can and can't do in our world today. But the ancient world was not so accommodating to young widows. Women in those days were profoundly dependent upon their husbands and their families. A younger widow like Ruth or Orpah would typically go back to their original families. They would remarry and start anew, a new chapter in their lives. Older widows typically would depend upon their children. Normally, women had children, and if you were an older woman who lost her husband, well, you would probably move in with your children, and they, if you had sons, at least they would take care of you. So widows in those days were very dependent upon their family, whether their original family or their new family, their own family. Typically speaking, widows or women in general did not have kind of an independent lifestyle where, you know, you just go find a job and get an apartment and get a car and take care of your own business, how we do it oftentimes in our world today. Widows of that age and that era really didn't have those options. And so typically in the Old Testament, when we have a list of the most vulnerable, the poorest, the most likely to be in poverty, what kinds of people are those? Well, the list would include orphans, foreigners, and widows. Because a widow without a family was generally stricken by poverty and destitution. She didn't have much to go on. There were not a lot of options for widows at that time in that society. Well, last time we looked at the introduction of the book of Ruth, and we talked about Naomi and her family sojourning in Moab. And then unfortunately, Naomi's husband died. And then a little bit after that, Naomi's two sons died. And so that left Naomi with her two daughters-in-law, Orpah and Ruth, three essentially destitute women, widows, all of them. And because they, especially Naomi, didn't really have a family to go back to, she urges her two daughters-in-law to go back to their original families. These people would not have been that old. We kind of imagine that they were maybe in their mid-20s, something like that. They're not old people, and so they could go back and they could restart with their original family and get remarried and have a happy life. And so this is what essentially Naomi encourages her daughters-in-law to do. Well, today we'll look at Naomi and the fact that she returned to Bethlehem with Ruth. Now remember that the theme of the book of Ruth is about God demonstrating his faithfulness by loving, superintending, and caring for his people. And so the journey back to Bethlehem then is the beginning of God's process of providing for Naomi and a convert to the worship of the true God of Israel, namely Ruth. So let's look at these verses and consider what they can teach us today. First of all, we find that Naomi decides to return to Judah after hearing that God has visited his people with food or with bread. Notice again verse 6. She arose with her daughters-in-law that she might return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the country of Moab how the Lord had visited his people with giving them bread. So Naomi decides that her best option would be to return to Judah, because the Lord had ended this famine. You may remember that there was a famine in the land. That was the original cause that got Naomi's family to move away from the promised land to go to Moab. So who knows how she learned this? It doesn't say how she learned it. Maybe through letters, through travelers, visitors. In some respects, she learned, one way or the other, that now God had provided the end of this famine, and now that there was bread back in Bethlehem. Remember, the name of that town, Bethlehem, means house of bread. And during the famine, there was no bread. But now the Lord had visited his people, and God had ended this famine and provided bread for the people. The reason for this change is that the Lord had visited his people. It's not simply a change in climate. It's not a change that the weather had changed or that the cloud had moved in and that it had just happened to rain. No, she said that the Lord had visited his people. So Naomi very clearly understands that the reason that these things happened, the reason that the famine ended, and now that there was bread back in Bethlehem again, was the Lord's visitation of his people. You know, in the ancient times, people were very much more dependent upon nature than we are today. In those days, of course, everything depended on patterns of weather, everything depended upon the farming, everything depended very deeply on nature. For us today, we're a little bit more removed from nature. How many of you got your bread by going out into the wheat field and harvesting the wheat and, you know, taking care of the wheat to provide a loaf of bread? I don't know where our bread comes from. It just shows up in a plastic paper or plastic bag, and I take out the bread, and it comes, I suppose, from the grocery store or from Quick Trip or wherever my wife gets bread. But I'm not a farmer. I don't really depend directly on the weather and the farming and things like that. So am I not dependent then upon the providence of God to give me my daily bread? Well, no, we are all directly dependent upon God one way or the other. It may be that we are farmers, or maybe we depend upon, you know, the trucker to bring the produce from one place to another, or we go to the grocery store. Wherever we get our food, however it comes to us, depends upon the providence of God. It really depends on God visiting his people and providing for them. And remember, the book of Ruth is all about how God provides in a really remarkable way for his people. And God provides for us as well. We are just as dependent upon the Lord as Naomi and Ruth and Orpah are here. If the Lord doesn't provide for us, it's just like a famine. You know, we're not going to have anything if God doesn't provide for us. And so Jesus instructed us to pray, give us this day our what? Daily bread. We are to recognize our dependence upon God. Even if we're going through a famine or whatever the weather situation is, whether it's good or bad, we recognize ultimately everything that we have comes from God, whether it's food, clothing, a job, health, skills, all those things. Just like these women were utterly dependent upon the Lord visiting his people, we are still today depending upon the Lord visiting us or taking care of us and providing what we need. So the three women, then it says in verse 7, begin traveling toward Judah. She went forth out of the place where she was, there in Moab, and her two daughters-in-law with her. So it seems as if maybe these women are going to, they think, or they're going to go with her all the way back to Judah. But it's not too long before Naomi realizes that this is not going to work out. These daughters-in-law can't come back with her to Judah. So then she, secondly, number two this morning, she encourages the daughters-in-law to return to their own families. Notice verse 8, Naomi said unto her two daughters-in-law, go, return each to her mother's house. The Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. So she, first of all, says, return to your mother's house. So again, typically a young woman, if a younger woman were widowed or divorced, she wouldn't simply just go out on her own independently. She would return to her mother's house, her original family. And then hopefully she could begin a new chapter in her life. Hopefully she would find a husband, and that would be the best option. The best interest for a woman like that in that situation would be to return to her mother's house. The prospects of Orpah and Ruth would be better if they did that. To go home and begin a new chapter in their life was really their only hope. So that's what Naomi encourages them to do. Naomi wishes that the Lord would deal kindly. Notice she says, the Lord deal kindly with you. This is the first instance in the book of Ruth of the important word hesed. This Hebrew word literally means loving kindness or steadfast love. And so Naomi entrusts them to the loving kindness of God. She here is invoking God's blessing upon them. And notice how the relationship is described here. The Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. So they've all gone through this tragedy. Of course, Naomi has lost both her husband and her sons. These two women have lost their husbands. So in the process of this great disaster, this great trial and crisis in their lives, they pulled together, it seems as if, and they showed loving kindness to one another. They showed this steadfast love and compassion and encouragement to one another. These three women together encouraged one another as they went through these difficult times. So Naomi desires that God would bless them because they have been a blessing. She desires God's kindness upon them because they have been kind to her. Well, you know, in times of difficulty and crisis and disaster, family and friends need to uphold and support one another through these difficult times. Families need to pull together to provide loving kindness, grace, and compassion to those who are grieving. In this case, all three women suffered a great tragedy, and they all pulled together to show loving kindness and compassion toward one another. And you know, we need to be sensitive and sympathetic within the church as well. I suppose we expect that from family, but the church is a kind of a family also. And when people go through tragedy, disaster, suffering, pain, and death, well, it's then that the church needs to pull together and show sympathy and support and kindness and help to a person, all those who are going through that kind of disaster. So we need to be, you know, sensitive. We need to be watching out for the needs of others and the difficulties that they're going through. Well, she goes on to say in verse 9, "May the Lord grant you that you may find rest, each of you in the house of her husband." The word rest here signifies the blessing and security of a husband and family. She wants them to enjoy a happy and peaceful life, the life of security and comfort with their husbands. Now remember, in that culture, the woman's well-being was directly linked to her husband. So the prospects of these two widows, these younger women, Orpah and Ruth, the prospects for them would be much better if they went back to their Moabite families and just sort of started over, started a new chapter in their lives, tried to, you know, find a husband or some way to establish a regular family in their lives. Naomi is hopeful that the Lord would bless these women by finding rest in the families of their husbands. And you know, there's nothing wrong with that idea or that belief that women fare best with a husband and a family. A stable marriage is a source of security, well-being, and provision. In our culture, it's kind of the opposite. There's kind of a feminist idea that is very common in our culture today that women really don't need men in their lives. They can have security and stability, in fact, without men better than with men. Of course, there are many people who have experienced real tragedies with men. They've gotten a hold of and married some very bad men, and frankly, women can do better without these bad men. But we should not have this feminist idea, this culturally common idea today, that women don't need men. The best option is to follow the biblical pattern of a man and a woman forming a relationship, a lifelong relationship, that results in having a stable family. Today, there's the kind of idea, maybe I think I've mentioned it before, you've maybe heard it before, a woman needs a man like a fish needs a bicycle. That's kind of a funny way of putting it, but the idea is that women don't need men. They can get along just fine without them. And yet I would say that the biblical pattern shows that women and men, you know, they correspond, they get along well, and as long as you have a good man in your life, it's probable that your life as a woman is going to be more secure, more comfortable, more successful if you are in a loving and kind relationship between a man and a woman, which of course is the family, a married family where you are committed to one another for your life and you raise up children in that stable environment of the married family. So there's nothing wrong with encouraging women to seek rest, security, comfort in the family of her husband. Get married, have children, and establish a stable relationship and a stable family. That's what she is hoping for these women. Well, she goes on in verse 9, she kisses them and they lifted up their voices and they wept. Kind of an interesting way of describing it, lifting up their voices and weeping. You may be familiar that in the Middle East and in this culture, loud wailing and weeping was acceptable. That's how you often express your dissatisfaction or your sorrow, is loud wailing and weeping. Typically speaking, we don't see that too often in our culture, but that's how they did it back then. They lifted up their voices and they wept. But Naomi's daughters-in-law say in verse 10, "Surely we will return with thee unto thy people." So they both express an interest in coming with Naomi back to Judah. They're so attached to Naomi that they're willing to leave their home country, their friends, and everybody back at home and go with her. Their devotion to Naomi showed their deep personal relationship that these three women had. Orpah and Ruth were attached to Naomi, and they're very reluctant to sever that attachment. Now remember that Naomi is the mother-in-law of these two women. Now how often do we hear about a difficult relationship between women and their mother-in-law? It's almost a joke that people talk about their bad relationship with a mother-in-law or the in-laws in general. Well, here we have a case where these two women, Orpah and Ruth, are so dedicated and so committed to Naomi, their mother-in-law, that they're willing to leave home to be with her. And that suggests that a relationship between the mother-in-law and daughters-in-law can be very good. It seems as if this is a good relationship. And so if you want to have a good relationship with your daughters-in-law or prospective daughters-in-law, you need to be the kind of person that can achieve that kind of a close personal relationship. And I know that in many families, the relationship between in-laws is not good, to put it kindly. Sometimes it's very confrontational. Sometimes people just don't get along. But as a Christian, if you're a Christian woman, you ought to do everything you can to have a good relationship with your daughters-in-law. And, you know, this is obviously something that was here between these three women. Well, Naomi discourages the women then from returning with her. In verse 11, Naomi said, "Turn again, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Are there yet any more sons in my womb that they may be your husbands?" So why do you want to go with me is her mild kind of a rebuke. She's basically pushing them away and saying, no, you don't really want to come with me. It would be a foolish thing for them to accompany her back to Judah. Essentially, she's saying here that my situation is hopeless. She is an older widow. She has virtually no prospects of success or happiness going back to Judah. Those are her people, that's her home, but she is an older widow. It's highly unlikely that she would ever find somebody to marry her. You know, older, poor, poverty-stricken women are, in that culture at least, are just not very attractive. Husbands would not be lining up to, you know, have her as a wife. So she's going to go back to a place where she has nothing. I mean, those are her people back there, but frankly, she is expecting virtually nothing when she goes back to Judah. There's bread back there. The famine is done. But she doesn't look forward to anything particularly positive happening to her. So she says, no, this is not a good idea. And she gives several reasons why this is not a good idea. First of all, in verse 11 at the second part, "Are there yet any more sons in my womb that they may be your husband?" Now, why does she bring that up? Sons that they may be your husband? Well, this is the first indication, the first hint of this idea of levirate marriage. And you know from the Old Testament that if a woman lost her husband, if she was a widow, then the brother of the husband could marry this woman and bring up seed or bring up the family in the name of the dead man. So this was not only a traditional thing, this was something Deuteronomy 25 teaches that this is, you know, this is what's supposed to happen. If a widow does not have any children, then the brother-in-law, levirate marriage, that word lever is the Latin word for brother-in-law. So Naomi basically says here, I'm not going to have any more children that can be the brother-in-law to grow up and marry you to produce children for your dead husband. That's simply not going to happen. You know, from all appearances, this is a hopeless situation. And that's one of the powerful elements of this story is that God is able to take a hopeless situation and have it turn out positively, have it turn out in a hopeful way. We know that with God, all things are possible. And even though this is a hopeless situation, as if it seems there's nothing good is going to happen with from or to Naomi, and yet we find, if you read later on in the story, we find that this happens, this situation turns out very positively. So we recognize that with God, all things are possible. Naomi thinks that this is impossible at this point, but we recognize that with God, all things are possible. Well, if she did bear sons, the woman would not wait around for them. Obviously, this is kind of a ridiculous idea. We're talking about, you know, waiting around for 20 or more years to marry these little boys as they grow up. She's trying to convey the idea that there's no hope for the future, and these women would have a better hope if they returned home. From a human point of view, Naomi appears to be right. And so these women may as well go home and restart their lives. Their chances for success is better in Moab than it is in Judah. So at the end of verse 13, well, verse 12, did we read that? "Turn again, my daughters, go your way. I'm too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope If I should have a husband also tonight and should also bear sons, would you tarry for them? Would you stay for them from having husbands? No, my daughters, it grieveth me much for your sakes that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me. It grieveth me much. Literally, that word in the original is bitter. It makes me bitter. So Naomi is angry, you might say. She is bitter over the fact of how, as she says, the Lord's hand has gone out against me. In fact, it's kind of an interesting statement here. It grieveth me much for your sakes. Looking at the original language here, perhaps means something like, my bitterness is greater than yours, or maybe my life is too bitter to share. That seems to be the idea here. She's saying, what is in front of me is hopeless situation. There's nothing but bitterness awaiting you if you are attached to my life. So Naomi's situation is worse than her daughters-in-law. Orpah and Ruth could go back home, and their prospects for remarriage and children was still good. But Naomi's prospects were quite bad. And she says that the reason here is that the hand of the Lord has gone out against her. God, she says, is ultimately responsible for this loss of her husband and her son. So this is not merely chance. This is not bad luck that has happened. This is within the providence of God that these disasters have struck her. So she blames God for the famine and for the deaths of her husband and her sons. And it's interesting here that she doesn't say that this is unfair. She doesn't charge the Lord with unfairness here. And so that seems to me to indicate that perhaps Naomi recognizes that it was wrong for them to have left Judah, the promised land, and to sojourn in Moab, and for their two sons to marry Moabite women. The hand of the Lord has gone out against me in the sense that this is chastisement for my sin. That would have been the Jewish way of looking at this when disaster and tragedy like this happens, with the three men dying and the two women being childless. She comes to the conclusion that this is God's hand going out against me, and she doesn't say that it was unfair. She doesn't say that I didn't deserve this kind of treatment. She just recognizes this is God's hand of chastisement going out against me. Well, do you ever feel like God's hand has gone out against you? When disaster strikes, I think for Christians, for those with a theological point of view, we would recognize that God is involved in the difficulties of our lives. If we believe in the sovereignty of God, then we also believe that God is in control of both blessings and adversity. Job chapter 2, verse 10 says, shall we receive good at the hand of the Lord, and shall we not also receive evil? That's the King James word. It could be translated, though, as disaster or adversity or trouble. Shall we not receive blessings and potentially adversity, trouble, disaster? Well, if you've been living sinfully, then you should not be surprised when disaster strikes. God promises to chastise his children when they're disobedient. God is like a loving father who makes sure that his children receive the kind of discipline that they need. So if you're living in open, unrepentant disobedience, well, you should expect chastisement. We don't know for certain that God is chastening or disciplining Naomi and her family here, but it certainly appears there are certain hints that that is the case. They had done wrong in leaving the promised land and going to Moab. And if you are living in stubborn, rebellious disobedience, well, you should expect some chastisement as well. Well, going on here in verse 14, we have that they all weep again. They lifted up their voices and wept again. Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clave unto her, or clinged to her. So Orpah kisses Naomi goodbye at this point. She suddenly or finally realizes that her prospects are better if she goes back to Moab. And it turns out, we find in verse 15, that Orpah has turned and gone back to her people. So we know that the kiss here is a farewell kiss. They lifted up their voice and wept again, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law. In other words, kissing her goodbye. She's leaving. She's going back to her family there in Moab. But Ruth refuses to leave. She's clinging to Naomi as if she's grabbed her by the feet or by the arm or something like that, and she absolutely refuses to go. But Naomi encourages Ruth to follow Orpah's example. Return to your people, and unfortunately, she says, return to your gods. So So notice verse 15. She said, behold, thy sister, that's Orpah, has gone back unto her people and unto her gods. Return thou after thy sister-in-law. So normally speaking, you know, you worship the god or gods of the land in which you lived. Does anybody know the name of the Moabite god? He's called Chemosh. Now, that's a false god. That's an idol. We know that the fact that these gods are mentioned doesn't mean that they are actual, you know, persons or that they have existence. But they were worshipped. These idols were worshipped. And so if you lived in Moab, Chemosh was the chief deity. Now, the people often worshipped a multitude of gods, but the god of Moab was Chemosh. Oddly, or unfortunately here, Naomi says, go back to your people and to your gods. Now, that should never come out of the mouth of a faithful Jewish person. That should never come out of our mouths that we would say, well, return to your false idols. But unfortunately, that's what Naomi does here. Somebody put it this way. Her theological perceptions at this point seem no more orthodox than many of the characters in the book of Judges. If she represents the highest level of the faith of Israel, it's no wonder that Yahweh has sent a famine on the land. So if Naomi is an example of the kind of faith that was common in the Israelites at this time, well, that's not a very good faith that sends someone to go and worship false idols. So we find that Naomi's character is a little bit questionable at this point. Her faith is wavering, you might say. Her commitment to the God of Israel is somewhat suspect. Well, let's go on to see what happens next in verse 16. Ruth said, now this is Ruth's first speech in the book, but it's a doozy of a speech. It's a great speech. This is one of the greatest pledges of loyalty and devotion in all of ancient literature. It's one of the most memorable passages in the whole Old Testament. It's a beautiful expression of loyalty and love. And so notice what she says in verse 16. Entreat me not to leave thee or to return from following after thee, for whether thou goest, I will go. And whether thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God, my God. Where thou diest, I will die, and there I will be buried. The Lord do so to me, and more also, if aught but death part thee and me. So this is a wonderful expression of loyalty and love. And as I said, that word hesed means steadfast, loyal love. And so this, although the word is not used, I don't believe, in that passage, still that idea of steadfast love, loyal love, commitment, compassion, we find all these things wrapped up in this expression. She commits herself here to following Naomi, living with her, adopting her people, following her God, even dying where she dies. She's committed herself to sharing Naomi's home and family. She feels obligated to Naomi, and so she's going to accompany her. So while Naomi's character seems a little bit suspect and questionable here, Ruth's character begins to really shine through. We begin seeing that Ruth is really a stellar character. Naomi is a little bit questionable, but Ruth is beginning to prove herself as a genuine follower of God. And so notice in verse 17, she does make a commitment here to the Lord. The Lord do so to me and more so if aught but death separate me and thee. Thee and me. So she swears this solemn oath. She swears in God's name, invoking God to hold her accountable for this promise. She's ready to be severely punished. The Lord do so to me, more so. The idea is, may God pour out all kinds of curses upon me if I fail to follow through on this promise. If I renege on this promise, may God curse me. May all these terrible things happen to me if I don't follow through on this promise. Now, at the end of verse 16, it seems like thy people shall be my people, thy God, my God. That speaking shall be. It's like it's in the future. So it's hard to tell here if Ruth is already a believer or if this is her profession of faith. She may have been a believer. Maybe she became a believer when she married Naomi's son, or perhaps she did not. One way or the other, whether this is her conversion or if this is an affirmation of her faith, we know from this point on, Ruth believes in the God of Israel. She has, from this point on, switched allegiance from Moab to Israel, from Chemosh to Yahweh. That fact, of course, will prove itself as the story goes on. We see Ruth's godly character from this point on And I think that is a reflection of the fact that she has come to put her trust under the wing of the God of Israel. And as I was looking at this, you know, she's really switching from the God of Moab to the true and living God of Israel. There's a passage in the New Testament that puts it this way: ye turned to God from idols to serve the living and true God. That, I think, is a correct expression of genuine conversion, turning from idols to the true and living God. Oftentimes today in evangelism, when people are trying to lead others to the Lord, they really skimp on that idea of turning from sin and turning to Christ. They put a lot of emphasis on faith, but not so much emphasis on repentance. Well, here, obviously, Ruth is turning away from idolatry, turning to the true and living God of Israel. And that, I think, is very important. As we seek to lead people to Christ, we do put that emphasis on turning from idols or turning from whatever it is that they were believing in to faith in Christ. Repentance and faith is the correct response to the gospel. Well, in verse 18, Naomi finally agrees. When she saw that she was steadfastly minded to go with her, then she left off speaking unto her. So she recognized that Ruth is committed to this. She's steadfastly minded, and so she stops protesting, and she allows Ruth to accompany her to Judah. It probably helped now that Ruth has made this verbal commitment. Your people will be my people. I'm no longer going to be a Moabite. Your God will be my God. I'm no longer going to be a follower of Chemosh. So maybe that sort of did the trick in Naomi's mind, that this woman is no longer considering herself to be a Moabite, that she is ready to make the commitment to my people and the true God of Israel. And so she agrees to allow her to come with her back to Bethlehem. And so in verses 19 through 22, then we find Naomi and Ruth arrive in Bethlehem. Kind of interesting language. It says, they too went until they came to Bethlehem. They journeyed. They went until they came. Now this is probably 50 to 60 miles. If you remember where Moab is, it's on the east side of the Dead Sea. And you have to go up north of the Dead Sea, across the Jordan River, then down a little bit into Judah. So it's not a huge distance, not like a couple hundred miles or something, but it's 50 to 60 miles. And how do you suppose that two destitute women traveled 50 to 60 miles? They probably walked. So how long would it take to walk 50 or 60 miles? Some of us would take 2 or 3 weeks to walk that long. But these people were, you know, they were used to walking long distances. It maybe took them no more than 2 or 3 or 4 days, maybe, you know, right in there, probably half a week or a little bit more than that. And they finally arrived in Bethlehem. And notice in verse 19, it came to pass when they were come to Bethlehem that all the city was moved about them. And they said, is this Naomi? So they get there to Bethlehem. This was not a large town at this time, and people, I assume, they pretty much knew one another fairly well. Naomi had been gone for about 10 years, and the people recognize her, and it creates a bit of a stir, creates a bit of a buzz in town when they get back. This word was moved in verse 19. It came to pass when they were come to Bethlehem, all the city was moved. It's kind of an interesting word in the original language. It means to hum, or to make a noise, or to be in an uproar. So today we might say the city was buzzing or humming with the news that Naomi had returned to town. And notice they ask the question, is this Naomi? So perhaps they're just stunned that Naomi came back to town, or perhaps they've noticed a real change in her appearance. Well, of course, 10 years, the years are not kind to most of us. As we go through time, our appearance changes. So maybe it's just 10 years, but remember, she's gone through the grief and the struggle, the problems of a dead husband and 2 dead sons. So this is a lot of stress, a lot of crisis, a lot of disaster that she's endured over the course of 10 years. It might be totally reasonable and understandable that she has really aged in these 10 years. And the people of the town look at her and say, is that you? I can hardly believe that that's you, because your appearance has changed so much over these 10 years. That's a possibility. Well, she says in verse 20, she said unto them, call me not Naomi, call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. The word Naomi means pleasant or beautiful or good, but she changes her name here to Mara, and Mara as you probably know, means bitter. She's bitter because of everything that's happened to her. Notice verse 21, she explains why she's bitter. I went out full, and the Lord has brought me home empty. Well, of course she did. She left with her husband and her two sons, and now she's coming back without them. She is empty. Now, in a certain case, in a certain sense, I feel bad for Ruth, because Ruth's standing right next to her, and she says, I'm empty. Well, Ruth probably thinks, well, what am I? You know, chopped liver, I'm standing right next to you. I came back with you from Moab. I'm here to help you. And Naomi says, I'm empty. I have nothing. Well, in reality, Ruth is right there. But she's bitter because she's now empty. Her words are, I think, are a little bit self-centered. She's throwing something of a pity party. Woe is me. Look what's happened. All these terrible disasters have befallen me. You know, I think it's natural for us to focus on our grief and our feelings of sorrow when disaster strikes. We can't pretend that we don't have these feelings, but we don't want to get into bitterness. We don't want to allow ourselves to descend into bitterness over the difficulties that have happened in our life. Grief is a natural response, but Naomi, I think, gives into this not only grief, but bitterness. When people are grieving over the death of loved ones, we should give them time to grieve. I think grieving is a natural process. Some of us have been through that, some of us have not. But sometimes people feel badly because they're still grieving. If you've talked to Vern, for example, his wife died about 10 years ago, and he still tears up when he talks about her. That grief is going to be with him for the rest of his life. It changes, you know, over time. It you know, it's not the same as what it was, but that grief is still there when you suffer the loss of a loved one like that. So we certainly recognize that. We want to be compassionate to people. We want to understand them. But we don't want to let that sorrow turn into bitterness. Bitterness is that anger over what has happened in the past. And it's an anger, really, in this case, it's at God. God, the hand of the Lord has gone out against me, she says. So she's bitter over how God has treated her. Well, we have to believe that God is for us, not against us, and that all things ultimately work out for his glory and for our good. We don't have to be bitter in the face of these kind of disasters. But notice what she says here at the end of 21. Seeing the Lord hath testified against me, and the Almighty hath afflicted me. Well, to testify against means to offer charges in a court of law. It is to show that the criminal action has occurred. To testify against one is to show that what they did was sinful. And so again, we see the possibility, the hint here, that it really was sinful in the eyes of God for them to leave the promised land, to go to Moab, and then for these men to marry Moabite women. To her way of thinking, Yahweh has called her to account and declared her guilty. She believes the Lord has caused these things to happen because of her sin or her family's sin. I wonder how often we become angry with God for the consequences of our own sins. You know, the Bible says, be not deceived, God is not mocked, whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. I think sometimes people get angry with God when they are involved in sinful activity and then consequences come from that that are negative. Negative consequences happen oftentimes, especially for believers, when you are engaged in sin. And so we should not get bitter. Really, we should expect it, if we are engaged in sin, apparently like these people were, for the Lord to bring disaster into our lives is not unusual. It should not be surprising if we are disobedient and serving ourselves, being selfish. If the Lord would bring disaster into our lives, we should not be surprised by that. Well, notice the summary statement then here at the end of chapter 1. Verse 22 says, so Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law with her, which returned out of the country of Moab, and they came to Bethlehem in the beginning of the barley harvest. Now that's kind of an interesting little detail at the very end to throw in there. This is at the beginning of the barley harvest. How would two destitute widow women care for themselves in a place where they have nothing? She's empty. They have nothing. How can they provide for themselves? Well, we know according to the Old Testament law that they could glean in the fields after the harvesters. This is in probably April, May time frame, which was the harvest of the barley. And so we have a glimmer of hope here that these two women are going to be able to keep soul and body together because they can go out in the fields and gather barley after the harvesters. Plus, the author here gives us a little bit of a hint about what's going to happen next. He draws us into the rest of the story because the rest of the story revolves around what event? Ruth going out into the barley harvest. So it's kind of a unique and very skillful way that the author weaves in this little hint about what's about to happen and leads us into reading the rest of the story. Well, with the end of chapter 1, we come to the end of the first part of this book. As readers, we're not quite sure what to think about Naomi. She seems to believe that God is good. She invokes God's blessing upon her daughters-in-law. She believes that God is sovereign over the events of her life. Yet she also encourages Orpah to return to her gods. Instead of repenting of her sins, instead Naomi complains that God has been unkind to her. God unfairly took away her husband and her sons. She went out full, she returns empty, and because of that she is bitter. So the picture we get of Naomi is not entirely positive. She's a believer, but she's also deeply unhappy about God's work in her life. Tragedy has made her bitter. She doesn't seem to think that Ruth is going to be of much value either. But Ruth, on the other hand, has made a beautiful and a memorable statement of loyalty and support for this old, bitter woman. She's left her homeland and ventured to a new city where her future is uncertain at best. And so, will Naomi's emptiness ever be filled? Will her bitterness turn to joy? Will Ruth turn out to be an asset or a liability? Well, tune in next time to find out what's going to happen in the brilliant book of Ruth. Let's close in prayer.